Hello, this is Mike Burek, your host and producer of Krynitsia, The Well, a podcast series about topics of interest to Ukrainians around the globe. Today is Tuesday, December 19th, 2023. This episode is produced for The Ukrainian Weekly, a newspaper published in English in the US since 1933. Our guest today is Yulia Zizkina, who is a policy and advocacy attorney specializing in information policy and public international law. And she is also a senior legal fellow for the Ukrainian advocacy group, RASM. Welcome, Yulia. How are you?
Hi, Mike. Good. Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, and thanks for joining us today. To start off with, can you give us some information about your educational and professional background?
Sure. I'm a practicing lawyer. As Mike said, my main areas of specialty are public policy, international law, and also economic crimes. Previously, I was a fellow at the World Bank's Anti-Corruption Unit. And later at the Department of Justice Criminal Antitrust Division, where I helped investigate and prosecute economic crime. Then I worked at the Seattle Prosecuting Attorney's Office in the Economic Crimes Unit as a trial lawyer for several years. I was also at the New York City Conflicts of Interest Board, where I enforced violations of New York City's ethics and conflicts of interest laws. And presently, I work for the law firm Quinn Emanuel. I began volunteering with RASM in fall 2022, and since about early this year, I have been focusing almost exclusively on the topic that we're about to talk about today, transfer of Russian state assets. I was the principal author on the New Lines Institute report that first laid out the legal theory behind this in June, and since then, I've written numerous articles and spoken in various places on this subject. Most recently at the US Helsinki Commission hearing in Congress on making Russia pay.
Thanks for that introduction. So let's get started on our topic for today, which is the transfer of frozen Russian assets for the reconstruction in Ukraine. And my first question to you is, can countries legally transfer these assets at this point?
Yes, they can. And this is based in the doctrine of state countermeasures, which provides the legal basis for confiscation, transfer, and the repurposing of frozen aggressor state assets for reconstruction and reparations funding. Countermeasures are codified by the UN International Law Commission's Articles on the Responsibility of States, and they are a well-developed doctrine under international law. Countermeasures are a tool to enforce international obligations and to restore justice. They are specific acts taken by a state in response to a breach of international law by another state that would ordinarily be unlawful, but they become legal when in response to a prior internationally unlawful act. So, specifically in the case of repurposing assets, under customary international law, sovereign states are obligated to respect the sovereignty of other states, including their property. The countermeasure suspends that ordinary respect that one sovereign state extends to the property of another sovereign. So, more specifically, what do we mean by that? So, since Russia itself has violated and invaded the sovereignty of Ukraine, it is not entitled to the respect of its property if the confiscation is done as a countermeasure, as a means of fulfilling Russia's obligation for reparations, because it will not do that itself. In other words, like Philip Zelikow once wrote, bank robbers should not expect banks to honor their safety deposit boxes. Except in this case, the banks are national governments with jurisdiction over the perpetrator's sovereign accounts. The duty against internationally wrongful acts, which also carries the duty to compensate for those wrongful acts, is one that Russia actually owes to the entire world and not just to Ukraine. So any country has the standing and the ability to take countermeasures. In this sense, Russia left its duty for reparations in the hands of states that actually value justice, and now it is up to those states to act. And because Russia's conduct is so extreme, every state has a right to join into the countermeasures. The UN resolution from November 2022 also recognizes this when it calls upon member states to establish an international mechanism to accomplish reconstruction and reparations in Ukraine. And it's time that we act on this.
Yulia, does the legal situation differ between the European Union and the US?
Well, while domestic laws between countries might differ somewhat, the baseline is actually the same. Any country is entitled to take countermeasures. But at the outset, before we go into this question, I want to make a distinction. We are talking about individual countries of the EU, but not the EU as a whole. The EU as a whole does not need to act together, and the decision to take countermeasures is actually that of an individual country. So most relevant here would probably be Belgium, because the bulk of the assets are located in Brussels, about 180 billion of them. So it's a bit of a misconception to say that the EU needs to collectively authorize confiscation. That might be true for the sanctions regime, but countermeasures are intended to be decentralized. This is an important distinction, I think, to make, because realistically, the EU won't pass a decision on confiscation at the EU level, probably for many reasons, but not the least of which is because the Hungarian leader, Orban, would easily veto it. So when we talk about asset confiscation in Europe, we need to be talking about the G7 countries plus Belgium. That's actually the way forward. But anyway, back to the original question. The confiscation mechanism in an individual country might look a little different depending on that country's domestic laws. To use an example, in the US, the president already has the authority to use his executive powers under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act to compel US financial institutions that are holding these frozen Russian funds to transfer them into an escrow or other holding account and then distribute them according to international agreement. In Canada, for example, the same could be done via an order in council. And the mechanism for an EU country could look similar. A country's political leadership could unilaterally take action, or the legislature could pass a new law. But regardless, it should be an act of state, which means that it should go through the political branches, such as the executive or the legislative, but not the courts. This is an important point to keep in mind, and this is because going through the courts potentially raises issues of sovereign immunity. And this has been misunderstood, I think, since the very beginning when this discussion about making Russia pay started. Sovereign immunity is actually a doctrine that principally applies to the adjudicative actions of national courts. So, in other words, the doctrine of sovereign immunity bars the national court of one state from adjudicating in proceedings involving another state. But it actually doesn't have anything to do with the political branches, such as the president or the parliament or Congress, the political branches. So to avoid that, it's really the political branches that should be acting in each of these countries. The bottom line, though, is that the broad strokes are likely to be similar across jurisdictions based on international law and based on these common concepts. But domestically, it might look a little bit different based on a country's laws and their preferences.
So at this point, what are the major obstacles, both legally and politically, to the transfer of frozen Russian assets to help fund reconstruction in Ukraine?
Well, legally, I think the obstacles were previous misunderstandings of laws. Like I mentioned before, the misunderstanding about sovereign immunity and how it really only applies to courts, but not the president or the legislative branches. But however, after a lot of work on the part of those working in this space, those misunderstandings have been largely cleared up, and I think what remains are the political obstacles. The first one is sometimes still existing misunderstandings about, for example, de-dollarization or devaluation of the euro or concerns about retaliation. Both of those have been continuously debunked. Asset transfer would not result in de-dollarization or devaluation of the euro if the G7 moves together, because there are no other realistic currencies to hold reserves in. In terms of retaliation, this has been a fear with every weapon system that we've sent to Ukraine. With every HIMARS, all the ATACMS, the cluster munitions, we've always been worried about retaliation, but that has never proven to be a credible fear. And in terms of both de-dollarization and retaliation, There's no reason to think that confiscation would result in anything different than what the asset freezes already have. And the second, and I think probably the biggest obstacle, is political will. Unfortunately, I think a lot of political will comes about in a reactive manner. I'm not sure that the West felt that this was a time-sensitive issue for a while, even though it most certainly was, and even more so now, it still is. So in terms of political will, the more policymakers hear about this, the more the issue stays at the forefront. I encourage anyone who's listening to write or call to your policymakers to write op-eds and to make it clear that not only must Russia pay, Russia must pay now.
Julia, do you think any real progress will be made in 2024 on this?
I believe so, yes. Part of the reason, unfortunately, is the difficulty we're all seeing with securing funding for Ukraine. So attention is turning to these frozen assets as an alternate source of funding. But I do want to make clear that while Russia must pay and these assets must be transferred to Ukraine, this should be a supplemental source of funding, but not an alternate one. The costs far outweigh the amounts that are frozen, especially the more short-term costs that are necessary for Ukraine's survival, like reconstructing and rebuilding infrastructure in these very cold upcoming winter months. But regardless, I do see progress being made on this in 2024 as we inevitably start talking more about how to sustain funding for Ukraine, and these Russian assets could be a critical source of that.
Turning away from the topic of Russian frozen assets for the moment, what activities do you undertake in your role as senior legal fellow for the Ukraine advocacy group, RAZM?
So let me tell you a little bit about RAZM first. RAZM, to anybody who's listening, RAZM is a nonprofit organization, and it means together in Ukrainian. It was founded in 2014, and our mission is to build a democratic and prosperous Ukraine. We have a branch both in the US and in Kyiv. We're a bit different from many organizations because we do three things that organizations don't always do at the same time. We fundraise and deliver aid, like medical supplies and equipment. We amplify Ukrainian voices through educational and cultural programs and the arts. And we have an advocacy arm in Washington, D.C. The goal is to not just win the war, but to win the long-term prosperity and stability of Ukraine. I work with the advocacy team, specifically with government affairs. We work within Congress, the executive branch, and other places of influence to advance policy and to strengthen Ukraine, ensure its victory, and to bring Ukrainian American voices to the forefront of the policy discussion. One of our greatest strengths at RAZM Advocacy, where I am, is partnering with other organizations. RAZM is a founding member of the American Coalition for Ukraine, which is a coalition of almost 100 organizations across the US that are supporting Ukraine in some way or another. We are one of the organizers of the Ukraine Action Summit, where hundreds of constituents fly in from across the country to meet with their representatives and to advocate for Ukraine. It's really a special organization, and I'm so proud to be a part of it. And I encourage anyone who's listening to check us out online and find out how you can help.
Julia, unfortunately, we're just about out of time, but I do have one final question. You brought up the topic of the U.S. Congress. Do you think they will finally approve new funding to assist Ukraine in the war with Russia?
Yes, I do. I think it's more likely than not, thankfully. However, it will unfortunately be a hard fight, particularly over border issues and Israel issues. It's extremely disappointing that Congress didn't pass the supplemental funding before leaving for a break this year. Frankly, it's unacceptable that we're in this position at all. It's a betrayal of American interests, and it's a demonstration of weakness in the face of aggression that will embolden Russia, China, and Iran. It has already emboldened Putin, who launched a devastating attack all across Ukraine and gave a press conference about how the goal remains to destroy the Ukrainian state. Unfortunately, the dysfunction in Washington and Brussels, too, is bolstering Putin's belief that he will win the war simply by waiting for the West to give up. But using these $300 billion of Russian assets to help Ukraine will put a dent in this confidence. It would show Putin that the West is willing to take creative and even unprecedented measures to win the war. And the sooner that we make this decision, the more quickly the impact will be felt on the ground. So I do hope to see Congress finally approve new funding and for the frozen Russian assets to be part of that funding.
Yulia, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
I have been speaking with Yulia Zizkina, who is a policy and advocacy attorney specializing in information policy and public international law, and also senior legal fellow for the Ukraine advocacy group RAZM. You've been listening to Konnichiwa, The Well, a podcast series about topics of interest to Ukrainians around the globe. It's produced today for The Ukrainian Weekly, a newspaper published in English for the global Ukrainian community since 1933. I'm Mike Burek, your host and producer of Krenitsa. Until next time, that's all for now.